discussed, we like to talk about what we do and what we don't like. We like to talk about how this writer infuses the mundane with poetry, how this musician interprets a standard like no one else, how the brushstrokes of this artist are hers and hers alone. What we don't often talk about is money. Sure, art lovers might gossip about the price of a piece of work or a ticket to the theatre, but there isn't ever much discussion about fair payment for the artists themselves and how they can build careers without seeing much financial reward for a long time, if at all. At the end of the year, Wesley Enoch delivered the annual Philip Parsons Memorial Lecture talking about this in regards to theatre.
As artists, we are our own worst enemies. We agree to these compromised conditions so we can get the work made. The competition is such that we are prepared to assume long-term, unsustainable practices to build and sometimes maintain our career momentum. Maybe the future is where artists must balance the work that sustains us financially with our artistic work. Maybe the future is a renegotiation of the award system and the growth of more commercial models. Either way, this is a debate that must be had now.
I thought today we might take a chance to unpack this and talk about how artists, visual artists and writers, as well as theatre makers, make their way from emerging to established in a world where, financially, being an artist sometimes isn't the easiest option. Joining me for this discussion are art dealer Tim Olson from the Olson Irwin Gallery, literary agent Fiona Inglis from Curtis Brown Australia, and theatrical agent Nikki Glewis from Nikki Glewis Management. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Melanie. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you, Melanie.
I guess I'll start by asking you, Tim and Fiona, are visual artists and writers asked to work in these so-called compromised positions as frequently as theatre makers? We might start with you, Fiona.
It does happen. We feel our job is to protect our writers from being exploited. So we make sure that if anybody ever wants to use anything of our writers' work, that they A, seek permission, and B, in almost all cases, pay a permission fee. There is a worrying thing happening at the moment, though. The government are thinking about changing legislation to expand the definition of fair use in Australia. At the moment, you can use small parts of a writer's work in criticism or review, but they are thinking of expanding it so that the fair use definition is much broader, which will mean it's much harder for us to protect our writer's work and get fair compensation for it. So, yes, this is a very worrying thing on the horizon for writers, apart from what they already face.
Tim, does this extend into the visual arts world? Are visual artists often asked to do things for less than their market value?
It's an incredible thing now where we've got a lot of charities that approach us constantly about donating things. Right. And, we draw up a list of several charities a year and we draw the line. But it's got to the point that the artists have actually become the charity, you know, because people are buying the works from the charity auction and not from the gallery. Essentially, I think the greatest injustice has really been through the sale and distribution of Indigenous art in the past. Galleries have always had a very consistent basis of commission, which they take. VizCopy now is certainly protecting artists with copyright, so there's another flow of money. And also we've got the resale royalties, by which when an artwork is resold, the artist gets a piece of the action. So it's getting better. But our biggest problem really is the art market itself, which really is to do with a good economy. You know, arts policy helps a few, but it's a good economy that actually makes the art world most buoyant.
Let's go then to the beginnings of artists' careers, and we'll go to you now, Nikki Glewis. What stage of a career does an artist, an actor, a theatre maker usually come to you at?
I mean, in the first instance, I guess most of, well, certainly my actors come from schools. So they graduate from NIDA, WAPA. Mm-hmm. They've done their 3 years training. But of course, they can come from anywhere, anyone with a love for the art. I think the key to going back to Wesley's is I don't do it for the money. Mm-hmm. And I think for myself, the artists I love are the ones that actually can't be happy doing anything else. Mm-hmm. They have to act to be happy.
So how is it then, how do you negotiate working with them when, I mean, theatre makers I think probably are asked the very most to go and do a co-op production where it's a profit share, or to rehearse for 2 weeks out of their normal jobs and not be paid for it. How do you negotiate between what could be an opportunity and actually, the living of an artist?
I mean, if they're at that stage where they are doing independent productions, and I should say that very high-profile actors now are doing independent productions and simply, you know, going back to what I said, because they love the art form, they love making theatre. Generally, when it is an independent production, it is of the understanding that if a well-paying gig comes in, they can be extricated from it.
In the visual art world, Tim, how do you develop somebody from an emerging artist who is selling paintings, etc., for, you know, cheaply? How do you build them up?
It's really about getting the right people to love them, them and the artwork. The artist today is often the darling. Yeah, my father talks about when he was younger, he was the darling of Sydney.
So that's your father, John Olsen.
John Olsen, yeah, and he said it was a very precarious position to be in because it obviously has a flip side. But essentially, for an artist to be taken seriously, it's really a lot to do with whether they're real or not. And I think in my upbringing, I've certainly learnt to know how a real artist smells, in a way that it doesn't smell like turpentine, but... what I'm saying is that there has to be a certain authenticity there, and people aren't fools. I've seen very wealthy people with no idea about art having bad art thrust upon them and knowing that they just aren't the conditions of what is genuine behind it. And I think that transition from being an unknown artist to a great artist is certainly a lot to do with whether you've really got this sort of intangible X factor, and often it gets back to skill and whether you can actually draw and paint.
You're on Radio National and this is Weekend Arts. We're convening a panel at the moment about how artists negotiate their careers from emerging to established. And my guests are Tim Olsen from Olsen Irwin Gallery, Fiona Inglis from Curtis Brown Australia, and Nikki Glewis from Nikki Glewis Management. Fiona, how do you, with your clients, when they come into you as an emerging writer, how do they become a Christos Tolkis or somebody like that?
Generally, writers come to agents in two phases of their careers. One is when they're emerging, trying to get noticed for the first time, and the other is when they are better established writers and need someone to help manage their careers. So somebody like Tom Keneally, for instance, who is currently writing 3 full-length works and has a theatre production going on in New York at the moment, he couldn't possibly manage everything himself without having somebody to help him. But yes, more and more are there writers who come to us because they want to be noticed. 20 years ago, when you had to bang out a novel on an old Olivetti typewriter, there were far fewer of them doing it. But of course, everybody has a computer on their desks now, and there's millions of creating writing classes available online or at every institution in Australia practically. So it's much easier to think that you can write a novel or a work of nonfiction, but to actually get noticed is much, much more difficult. Publishers now mostly don't even look at unsolicited manuscripts. They say, we'll only look at your work if it comes via an agency. So that's the majority of our new clients are people who are trying to get going.
And do you have this darling factor as well that yes. Tim talks about?
Yes, it's definitely the case. I remember hearing Robert Desay give a speech one night and he said, these days writers have to not only be able to write, they have to be able to tap dance, which we all thought was hilarious, but it's true. I mean, you have to go out and promote your work as much as anything. I mean, that's part of the problem, and that's that they have so much pressure on them to go out and promote and be seen at writers' festivals and to meet their readers. And of course it works, but it takes away from writing time.
Now, Tim was saying earlier about so much of the art world being about what the economy is like. How are you each finding it for your clients? We might start with you, Nikki.
Well, it matters little really, because it's always a roller coaster in the industry. There's like 98% unemployment at any given time. The ups and the downs of what's happening in the real economy really has little bearing on our industry.
Tim Olsen, it sounds like it might be the opposite for your industry.
Well, we rely on slushy money, you know.
What's slushy money?
Money left over after everyone's paid the school fees, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, hasn't been a lot of that around.
Right.
And art is a luxury good. You know, people don't die if they don't buy art. So obviously it's been put on the back burner in recent times.
And does that mean that things are tougher for your emerging, your less established artists?
The people that are really suffering are the mid-career artists. The ones that are of a certain price bracket, which is still affordable, are doing okay. And then you've got the blue chip, which people notice are the investment ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's all the mid-career artists, which are in that sort of intermediary position. They're established to a point, but they haven't become a master. Their works are anything from $20,000 up to $150,000. Now, those artists haven't sold anything. There are artists who have gained tremendous respect to hung in museums and institutions, have books written about them, who just aren't selling a thing.
What about the master Australian artists? For example, John Olson. Are artists like that safe in this kind of economic climate?
You know, the thing about John's work is that he's still a darling.
He is a darling.
There's something about his work which people find refuge in. You know, it makes you smile. It takes you away from the grind or the stress of what everyday life is. His work is endearing, and so it's a form of escapism, like a good film or like a good book.
Mm.
And there are very few artists that can achieve that.
Fiona, the book world is really seeing some massive changes and has been for the last few years. So how is this economic climate reflecting in the work and the lives and the economic lives of your authors?
We are copying it from a lot of angles. Digital publishing means that writers get less money. People are buying books from overseas. Online sales have had a huge impact on our books, on our bookshop market here. So you're seeing bookshops closing all over the place. But I am sensing some optimism creeping back into the whole industry. I think we might have hit rock bottom and be coming up. I really do think that people are finding reasons to be cheerful, much more cheerful than they were even this time last year. A new writer is still probably only going to earn about $10,000, maybe $15,000 for a first novel. And sometimes that's 5 years' work. It's really, really, really tough. But there are writers like Christos who he's written five novels. So certainly The Slap was not at the beginning of his career, and he's worked really, really hard to get there. But people look to him and think he's worked really hard and he's now seeing success all around the world. So there are ways of looking optimistically at writers like that, and there are ways of them getting established.
So I'd like to talk now then about those sorts of artists, those Christos Tolkis, the John Olsons, and in the theatre world we've got the Cate Blanchetts, the Russell Crowes. Financially, I can imagine these artists would be in a fairly sweet spot. But are they extreme rarities here in Australia? Nikki?
I don't think so. I think you've only got to read all the papers and the magazines of how many Australian actors are now working globally. You know, it's currently pilot season. Bang, 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 they're all getting, you know, jobs over there.
What about in the literary world, Fiona?
I would say that it's very, very rare for somebody to have a first-time hit. We represent a writer called Hannah Kent, whose Burial Rites last year was published here in Australia and is currently being published in about 23 languages all around the world. That got enormous media attention because it's a one-off. Most successful writers in Australia get to the stage that where they're internationally successful because they've had five or six novels behind them. So there's been a long, hard struggle to get there.
In the visual arts, Tim?
Well, Australia still suffers a lot of intellectual or an artistic condescension from the Northern Hemisphere.
Right.
I just did a show of John's last year in London, which we really struggled with. Fortunately, from having taken John's work to art fairs in Hong Kong, the Asian collectors really understand his work. I mean, there's a lot of zenness in the, you know, the fact that there's a spatial qualities in John's work, which an Eastern sensibility gets before a Western.
Wesley Enoch had a number of suggestions in his lecture on ways to improve professionalism, and by professionalism I mean being paid for your work. Mm. What would you like to see happen in the future for your artists? We'll start with you, Tim.
If anything that we do have as a big wish list in the art world is for the government to make it easier for people to buy art.
And what about you, Nikki?
I think all the theatre companies have their heart in the right place as far as artists, because they rely on the artists, you know, for their work. And we are now seeing or reflecting slowly our culturally diverse nation, you know, on our screens, on our stages.
Fiona, what change would you like to see made within your industry in order to make things better for your artists?
I'd like to see more writers reading. Mm. You can't write unless you read. And writers need to support each other by reading each other's books. So the more they read, the better it's going to be for everybody.
Fiona Inglis there from Curtis Brown Australia. Her clients include Christos Tsolkas and Hannah Kent. Nikki Glewis from Nikki Glewis Management. Clients include John English and Tim Olson, whose gallery Olson Irwin represents artists like John Olson, Noah Taylor and Lila Jeffries.